And welcome everyone to a very, very special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
Not much, man. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good. I know we're both excited. Joining us tonight, we've got a very special guest, the amazing author and screenwriter Peter Craig. Peter helped to craft the screenplay for Ben Affleck's blockbuster crime movie The Town, along with Ben Affleck and Aaron Stockard. And hitting screens this weekend is his latest project, Bloodfather, which stars Mel Gibson, who seems to be back in major tough guy mode here, and it's an adaptation of his novel. Other screenwriting credits include The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, which he co-wrote with Danny Strong, and the hotly anticipated sequels to both Top Gun and Bad Boys for super producer Jerry Bruckheimer. He's an accomplished novelist with titles that include The Martini Shot and Hot Plastic. And while the future holds some very interesting big screen work as well, with an adaptation of Homer's Odyssey, an adaptation of Lindsay Addario's memoir It's What I Do for producer Steven Spielberg, and a really cool-sounding submarine action film called Hunter Killer with Gary Oldman and Gerard Butler. We're going to want to find out some more about that for sure. So this is a real treat and honor to have him here for a discussion. So welcome, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us for a chat.
Cool. Thanks. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, this is very cool. Your resume, I should say screenplay resume, is incredible. And you've been a writer for, or I should say a novelist for quite some time.
It's where I started. I went to Iowa for grad school for writing, just thinking I was going to be a novelist in the early 90s. I guess I graduated in 93. I was 22 or 3 when I got out. And then I didn't think I was going to write screenplays, but I kind of got into it from the novels, and they would sell movie rights, and that's kind of how I got into it. I just learned to do it watching other people. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you get involved with The Town? Because that seems like a big first screenplay.
It was.
Not saying it was your first screenplay, but, you know, first credited, I should say.
Well, The Town is a really interesting one because a lot of people don't know that Adrian Lyne was the director that was attached to that first before Ben was attached.
Oh, wow.
And Adrian Lyne he bought my second novel, Hot Plastic, and I was trying to adapt it for him. And then it got a little tangled, and then he briefly got interested in my very first script, which was never made. And then he came to me with Graham King, who'd also bought my first script. I knew both those guys, and they came to me. They came to me with The Town, and it had been. And Adrian and I worked in it a long time. Like, I'd fly to Marseille, France, and I'd work with him in his hospital room, like he'd had minor surgery or something. And he was this great, colorful guy. And it took really long time. It was a script that was too long, and he didn't want me to cut it much. It wound up being pretty similar to a lot of what Ben shot, but the truth is Adrian just kind of dug in and had a different version of the movie that was really expensive, and Ben came on and was a new generation of director that was just willing to do it cheaper, faster, and in a lot of ways that, not to say Adrian wouldn't have made a great movie, but Ben did a lot of things for it that I think really helped it. I mean, I think that kind of the gritty quality worked almost better with some of the limitations. So Ben came in and just got it going. I've never seen a movie like that where one director's off and then a couple of months later we had Ben come on and just go, let's do this. And Ben was so close to Jeff Robinoff at the time and to Greg Silverman and everybody at Warner's that they got behind him, supported him, and he got that movie done. That's the kind of movie that's really, really hard to get made, and a lot of it had to do with the faith that everybody had in him. So I got on it just through all those relationships that are so strange that you make with your early scripts that don't get made, basically. These first two scripts I'd written that a lot of people had read and were never made were like, they were kind of insider scripts that a lot of people liked and talked about. And that stuff can sometimes take you even further than the movies because nobody shoots it and messes anything up. You know, there's sort of like, everybody talks about the great scripts. I'm not saying these were great, but everybody talks about the good scripts they would have liked to have seen get made. And I was kind of lucky enough to get into that and get on those lists, like the Franklin Leonard was just starting the Blacklist in those years, and I was on it those first few years. And so people just knew who I was, and then the right thing kind of lands on you, and that project just didn't die. So it was great. And Ben did a great job. It's just across the board, he did an amazing job with that movie. So I got
as you said a minute ago, you said even with somebody like Ben Affleck and people having faith in him from his first film, from Gone Baby Gone, which was excellent, even though that it was based on a book, getting a film like The Town made seems like a risky proposition these days because of the fact that it's an R-rated adult drama that is not a CGI tentpole, and while it was certainly award worthy, it's more along the lines of those, you know, actioners that you would have gotten in the, you know, 70s. 90s.
Yeah, or the 70s. Even. I mean, it was sort of Friends of Eddie Coyle. Yeah, it was a Friends of Eddie Coyle kind of movie, or Straight Time, or those kinds of movies from the 70s. Yeah. It's really hard to get them made. It's even harder now because TV has really gotten so good and is taking up the slack. I mean, the need, because people really like crime movies. They just love them, but their TV is doing them so well that now people are wondering, you know, what's even the point of taking a $35 million risk when you can do it as a limited series or you can do it differently. So The Town was maybe the last of that era of that movie kind of at that price. Like, I think it cost in the mid-30s. There's movies like that being made for under 15 and for over 60, but there's not much happening at that range anymore. I lamented a little bit, except that the limited series is really good, and there is really a lot of interesting stuff happening on TV, and there is an awful lot of freedom for writers and directors and all kinds of creative people in that world. So if the slack is picked up somewhere, then great, as long as good stories are being told.
Yeah, Nick and I have said it a million times. The Town falls into that area of film to where now it would be made as a True Detective,
right,
of sorts. I feel like it would be an AMC show, or it would be a, like you were saying, it'd be an HBO limited run series, right, because we're in this kind of golden age of television where these stories are being told like that, and the only thing that's coming out now almost are hard indies or gigantic superhero films or franchise films.
Totally agree with you, Frank. I mean, that's exactly it. And that's what everybody talks about all the time, too, now. Like, now you'll go in and, you know, meetings are interesting now because everybody says, is this a movie or is this a limited series? It's like, that's the first decision everybody's making now. So, go ahead.
You know, it's interesting. Variety just had an article today. Obviously, this, you know, we're recording, you know, we're doing the chat now. The article literally came out yesterday, and it was talking about how any number of big budget, $150 million plus films this summer have completely crashed and burned. And, you know, this is something that Steven Spielberg had actually gone on record a few years ago saying that all it's going to take is one summer where a number of these big pricey movies implode. Do you think that there's any chance that Hollywood might learn from some of the lessons that they're receiving this summer from the seeming lack of interest from a large portion of people and might return to the, you know, medium budgeted movie? Because, I mean, you know, your credits are phenomenal. You know, inside Hollywood, people know you for a lot of stuff. I think that your name hasn't maybe appeared on in the credits. You know, you've done a lot of work on movies, and, you know, you've been brought on a lot of, like you said, scripts that haven't sold but are very well regarded. Do you think that you hear about this kind of stuff? Like, do you sense a trend of, you know, hopefully a return to the medium budgeted movie that you're talking about?
I don't think there's any return to the $25, $30, $35 million movie. I don't think that happens. I think what happens is in a way okay, though, because I think you're going to see a great creative array of $10 million and lower movies, and even $3-4 million movies. There's going to be a huge amount of really interesting smaller movies that are out there, and I don't think that's bad. I mean, I think it's I think the best are going to rise to the surface. I think it's going to be a really creative time again, like the 70s. I think the big tent poles aren't really going away anytime soon. There's always kind of money to come along and finance those because they're it's a gamble that pays off big sometimes for them. But I think you're just going to see a lot more like kind of Diary of a Teenage Girl kind of movies, and just like, you know, Dope, and movies that are just cool little movies that if you know, like there's a few more of them every year. And I think in a few years,
but not on a studio level, you don't feel.
I don't. I feel like we're going to have more and more interesting distributors, more and more interesting financiers, more and more people willing to take a risk. I don't think the middle range movie has an immediate future again. I mean, I don't. It's a strange model because there's a big chance to lose money and there isn't that much chance to make that much money. You know, it's and studios are in it to make money at the end of the day. Independent financiers, maybe not. And TV is so – you have such a guaranteed audience with TV that – and it's become so legitimized and it's gotten so good with – you know, Game of Thrones and True Detective and all these things that I just don't see how more and more people aren't going to find a sanctuary in there for the kind of smaller story that you want to tell. There's always going to be room for movies that are kind of awards movies and there's movies that are really real stories about people. But that kind of Paul Schrader, Scorsese type movie that I'm so into, I think it's going to have a run now in 10 episode television for a while. Yeah. I don't mean it pessimistically. I actually feel like it's the climate's changed in a positive way, that there's going to be a punctuated equilibrium that's actually going to make everybody a lot more creative for 5 or 10 years.
I hope you're right. I certainly hope you're right. You know, I'm of two minds. You know, obviously Frank and I are not, you know, we do not work in the industry. We're just passionate movie buffs. And, you know, we spend a lot of our time watching movies from any year, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, doesn't matter when, doesn't matter the genre. And we're constantly finding movies from all over that, you know, nobody's ever heard of, nobody talks about. And, you know, as you said, the dynamic really has changed. And I think one of the most exciting things that you brought up is all of the independent money that is brought to the surface by these financiers who either, you know, they may not be film buffs per se, but they've got a lot of money and they want to work with, you know, great filmmakers, and great filmmakers seize that opportunity and they know they can get away with making a movie that they won't be able to make at the studio level. So thankfully there are people out there who are financing these, you know, interesting films, like you say.
They're there. A lot of them are film buffs too. There's an awful lot of people here who want to make good movies, and they just and the studios come in and a lot of things that look like a studio movie once it's released, it wasn't when it was made. You know what I mean? It gets studio distribution or something. And there's it's a beautiful scramble in some ways, and I'm always amazed that there are so many people who want to do good work all the time. It's not. We're not overwhelmed by cynicism, despite the fact that there is a money side to it that's always the bottom line on some kinds of movies. Not all of them, but I don't know.
And you've had a chance. I mean, you've had the unique opportunity just from the printed credits that we can see. You've had the opportunity to work on films that, you know, something like Bloodfather that's coming out, where it's going to have a, you know, a slower rollout. And then you've worked on a juggernaut like The Hunger Games, and you're taking meetings with Bruckheimer and working with him on, you know, his stuff. So you've had this unique opportunity to see things, I would imagine, at a grandiose level and also on a more intimate scale.
Yeah, it was funny because I was on the set for the last two Hunger Games about – it was a 142-day shoot because they shot them back-to-back. I was there about, I think, like 95 days, and I had to leave before they went to Berlin. I was really sad. I really loved everybody on it. It was like a really great family on that set. And I had to leave because they were starting Bloodfather in Albuquerque, and that was a 28-day shoot with no money. And the whiplash of that was like, it was kind of great. Like, it was great to go from a movie where you couldn't have been treated better on The Hunger Games. Like, everything was rolled out for everybody. And you'd get to Albuquerque, and it was like I was rooming with a couple of guys. You know, I was sleeping on a couch, and we were just – and they're both really fun. Bloodfather was just frantic because you have no time to do anything. You have no money to do anything. New Mexico's crazy because you'll get a dust storm, and then it starts raining to stop the dust storm, and we can never make our days there. Whereas on Hunger Games, the schedule was, 10-hour shoots or 10-hour days. I mean, Francis was so gentlemanly in the way he did everything. We'd all be at dinner at night. And so that was really fun to get to see both of them. But then at the end of the day, they're just as stressful. I mean, you're still in the edit trying to make everything work. You're still living or dying on what every single person says. I'm a lunatic, so I'll even read, like, comment sections, and I'll be like, oh, that guy's right. That guy totally has a good point. You just want it to work. And it's like, I don't think anybody knows like how incredibly hard it is to get a movie to work and to connect with people emotionally. It's easier to be a novelist because if somebody doesn't like the first 20 pages of a book, they put it down. Like if you have them for a while, they're engaged with you. They're in the process and you've actually formed a kind of alliance with the reader. People go to a movie and enjoy sitting there and trying to find fault with everything. Like you're sort of naked and exposed, and I love it for that. But it's funny. It never feels good. You're never relieved. You're always kind of, you get off on the adrenaline of just always doing it and always working to make something better. And it's doesn't matter what the movie does. It's never enough. And I know everybody feels that way. So I take.
You're someone who reads reviews then.
Yeah, because I want to learn, because I think that when you're in the bubble, you don't learn anything. And I always feel like when you're in a room, there's always that one person that's kind of the naysayer in the room, and that's the person to listen to, because whenever everybody's high-fiving and has total consensus about everything, that's when you've just screwed it up the worst probably. And sometimes on Hunger Games movies, it was Suzanne Collins, who's always on the phone, and she's unbelievably active in it. And she was very hard to please. And, like, it's no coincidence that now, like, I'm really good friends with her. I really love her. I just went to some ceremony she had in New York, and it's like I'd go anywhere for her because she has so much guts to just, like, never let anybody be happy with her. You know, wait, we got to question everything. You know, and then on Bloodfather, it was this friend of mine that I was living with that, like, we had so little money on that movie. You have to do all these compromises. Like, you have to rewrite the night before because you realize you don't have the money to shoot what's coming the next day. And you get so relieved that you just made it work at all. And my best friend, this guy, Chris Briggs, on that movie, he just wouldn't let you rest. He's like, no, stay up another hour. I don't think we have it yet. I mean, that's the voice you need. And so I'll read reviews, too, because I think – there's somebody out there who's going to come up with something, an angle that I didn't think of at all, and they're going to be right, and it's going to help the next time around. Sometimes they're just mean. Like, sometimes they don't really know what you're going for, and they're really actually just taking a personal shot at somebody you care about on the movie or you. Even screenwriters take hits a lot for things that nobody knows how that turned out that way. But I don't mind that as long as some of them have insight, and almost always there's some of them that do. Like, there's some reviewers I read religiously because I think they're almost like professors, and if you stop being in school, you start doing just total shit and you might as well give up. So that's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
What was it like casting Mel Gibson in the lead of Bloodfather, considering that you had wrote the novel prior?
Yeah. He was cool. I mean, I wanted him for a long time, and the movie kind of almost came together and fell apart at one point before with other people involved. And but I'd always liked Mel, and I had some people always telling me, like, way back at the beginning, like, he had just done The Beaver, and everybody was saying, no, you can't use Mel, and all this stuff was blowing up. And I sort of stuck with the idea of it because he's sort of similar to the character, and I knew a lot of people that knew Mel and liked him, and so then when I finally met him, I heard that he was into it, and I went over to his house, and it was just him and I. We were hanging out. I remember he made me a steak sandwich and a bunch of coffee, and we were just sitting there talking. He's a really cool, intense guy who's like immediately just talks to you like he's known you all his life. And he was just talking about what a great cook he was. And he did. He made me this really good steak sandwich. And we just sat there and he went through every part of the script. And I thought, okay, he's in. This is great. I was like, are you willing to grow a weird looking beard? Or like, do you want to put on any weight? And, because the character in the book is kind of like let himself go completely. He grew the beard. He didn't want to put on the weight, which is fine. Like he looks like a badass in this movie, which winds up being better. And then Mel and I just got to be really good friends over the course of this whole time. And he's like, he's really gentle about all of his advice, but it was interesting to have him on set because he's a brilliant director. He knows everything about lighting, editing. His knowledge is so panoramic, and he was very delicate not to step on any feet or ruffle anybody's feathers. This was a very accomplished French director that was doing this movie. And Mel would just quietly bring up a point, and I'd bring it to Jean-Francois, who a lot of times would listen to it. And you know, we knew we had a very brilliant director who was acting in the movie. So I got to say that was a pretty fun experience to hear him just bashfully say to me, like, can you move that light just 2 feet that way? Or, you know, and then he was always right. I was like, oh, my God, look how much better that looks. So sounds tiny, but those things aren't really tiny. They wind up making a difference.
Yeah, this is very exciting because Nick and I are two huge fans of Mel Gibson, and I've really loved his acting career the past couple years, and I think it's been a very cool new wave for him in a way. I loved him in Machete Kills. I thought he was great in Expendables 3. I loved Get the Gringo. This just seems like a very exciting new role for him. And he just looks like he just looks like the ultimate badass in this movie, and I can't even wait to see it.
Yeah, he's really good in it. I mean, I remember the first day he shot, it was a Friday at the end of a full week, and we'd done a lot of stuff with Diego Luna, who's really good too. And we'd done a lot of stuff with Aaron that week. And then the first day Mel shot, a bunch of us just looked at each other and like, holy shit, that is a movie star. Like he fell right into it. The role was perfect, but he also has that magnetism that you forget not everybody had. You know, I've worked with incredible actors that still don't have that kind of magnetism. I mean, obviously Jennifer Lawrence has it and Philip Seymour Hoffman has it. I've worked with a lot of people that do have it. As soon as somebody has it, you know it. And he has these mesmerizing eyes. He's really just the character is so violent in this movie, and he's so violent in scenes where he's not supposed to be violent at all. I mean, they're supposed to be quiet, touching scenes there, but there's violence written into this character. He's seething all the time, and it's really fun to watch. I think it's the best part of the movie by far. It was definitely the best part of shooting it and editing it, and just getting to massage out that really great performance. And that's what everybody's saying too. Like there's, you know, even the reviews that want to kind of dump on it for whatever reason or be uncharitable to him, they're all admitting that he's really good in the movie, and they're all remembering what a fiery, great actor the guy is. So I'm happy for that.
The material, just based on the trailer and the premise, it seems to play to his strengths as an actor. And, you know, they got a great supporting cast, William H. Macy, Michael Parks, as you said, Diego Luna. I'm curious to know what it was like collaborating with Jean-Francois Richer, because this is a French filmmaker. Some people might know his work from the Mesrin and Killer Instinct, the two-part Vincent Cassel French gangster thing,
yeah.
Which I thought was just exceptional. What was it like working with him?
He's great. He had a really good sensibility for this. I'd known him for about a year before because we tried a few times to put it together. His English is not perfect, so it's sort of like he was really working on a just totally instinctual level. Sometimes he's a beautiful shooter, He relied on everybody around him, I thought, in a really generous way. And Mel really respected him. So that's why I think we got into a really good groove early on. And then the stuff that we were dealing with on that movie was really just New Mexico, which sometimes can get, you know, we had just these windstorms for days on end where we'd run to get a shot off as soon as the wind died down for a second. And, you know, there were days like that that really tested your ability to be patient. And I think he did a really good job with that because he had 100 days to shoot Mezrine, you know. And we had originally, I think, 20-something days on Blood Father. I think eventually we got 31 because we just kept fighting for extra days. And that's really by the seat of your pants. You know, Jean-Francois wasn't used to that, and I think he was relying a lot on instinct. And I think, you know, luckily his instincts are really good for this kind of crime movie, and his shots all look really good. The movie's shot really beautifully, so he did a really we're all in good shape. We had a good time at Cannes too. It was good to see him again.
And something else that's interesting about the project is that it's based on your book, based on your novel, and you adapted the novel. You adapted your own novel for the screen with another writer, at least according
and
to
yeah, right.
And so, what is that like adapting your own book with another person?
I don't know, it helps. It helps because it gives you a little, it gives you perspective. I mean, and you kind of go back and forth with the other person, and you have another person's sensibility that brings in it. She's a very good writer. I mean, she worked on Straight Outta Compton too, and she's known her for a long time. She was on this job. Warner's hired her for Blood Father long before I was ever a screenwriter when they first bought the book, so I knew her from back then. She and I got to be friends. Like, she came to a reading of mine in, like, God, where was it? It was like way out there in like Agoura Hills. So that's like how nice a person she is. She drove to Agoura to see me give a reading to like four people in a bookstore, like when there were still bookstores and readings like that. So, and she's just cool. We got along and she added a lot. I mean, she was a huge value added to this whole thing. And that's what we all felt like. And we felt good about her presence on all this.
Yeah, she's another writer like you, I think, that has a lot of very interesting credits and has done a lot of work on movies that either haven't been made or that have gotten a lot of attention in the screenplay form. I remember she wrote that Gucci script for Ridley Scott,
right,
which
right.
Everybody was flipping out about, and she wrote World Trade Center for Oliver Stone.
Right.
And you know, it's just I find the life of a screenwriter just so interesting because, you know, you guys you know, and I just want to spitball here, but it's like you get involved in these massive productions, and then, you know, you get called in to do rewrites on movies maybe that you're not involved with all day, and
yeah.
you're working on your own project probably on the side, and you've got something in your back pocket that you really want to sell. And how do you compartmentalize all of the stories that you have going in your head or that you're been contracted to write? And, you know, just...
It's really hard. Yeah. It's really difficult to do. I mean, there's I think the best at it is Scott Frank, who we all look up to a lot, I think, for his ability to work on a lot of different projects and add a lot to, you know, four different things. I remember, you know, and I've read some of his scripts that are just fantastic. He's come in and he's done a couple of weeks on things and done more work in 2 weeks than I can do in months. So I try to learn from a guy like that. I can't work on two things in the same day. You know what I mean? I need to know this one day is this, and then the next day is that. I don't like it even when I have to break up a few days in a row. So usually I have to kind of have a whiteboard and schedule. If there's a few projects at the same time, I have to kind of schedule out when I'm going to work on one or the other. When it's those things that you say where you come in and you do a weekly, you usually have to give it your all for that week. I mean, you don't want to be too timing anybody too much. And then there's sometimes projects where I feel a little exhausted because I've given so much to just that project. Like there's ones I've worked on just exclusively for a few months, and then I have to really catch up on something else. I mean, I don't multitask as well as it seems. I mean, I really do need to get in love with something and really believe in it in order to make it good, even if it's temporary. Even if I'm the seventh writer on something or I'm the ninth writer, it's like, you know, you still got to fall in love a little bit. I mean, you still, we've all had, you know, 2 week relationships with a girl that you're in love with her for those 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Or it's like, and you don't think about the history. You think about where you are in the moment, and you have to believe that much about what you're doing at the time. I know that's a troubling analogy, maybe to some of your viewers. No, but
Frank knows that analogy pretty well.
Yeah, we're good. I know all about that.
Well, it's a cool question though, and I totally get it. But just to give you an example, like that, it's what I do. Project. I mean, I gave it everything I've had. I'm up coming up for air from it now for a break while everybody figures out what's happening with it. But I definitely didn't work on anything else for a couple of months, and I was probably putting in, you know, 80 to 90 hour weeks of actual writing on that thing, and just to the point that I was hallucinating at the end of the day. You know, so it's that one, maybe that's not always healthy, but there's always somebody who's going to try harder than you out there if you're not going to try that hard. And I just have to remind myself, because it's like we have short lives too as screenwriters, and there's early 30s screenwriter who shows up here, or even God forbid the late 20s screenwriter. There's a few of them coming around, and they work really hard, and they're really attractive to the town, all, you know, to everybody here. And you better not be the comfortable, well-fed writer in his 40s. Like you better scare everybody that you're working so hard, or it's over. That's why I seem a little bit crazy, actually.
No, I mean, it would make, you know, again, to people who are not in the industry, this, you know, it would make sense. And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's tough for people who are not in the industry sometimes, who are very fascinated with the process of getting a movie made, to hear it from a screenwriter. Because, you know, like, what's the old saying? The screenwriter's first to be blamed and last to be congratulated, or something like that. You know, like you said in the reviews, people are quick to pick, you know, quick to pick on a screenwriter if they find fault. But, you know, the first person to get the credit is the director. And of course, the director is the one overseeing it. It's a film by so and so. But I've always just found it so interesting, the process of screenwriting, the attraction to material that you guys get. And when you get into this groove and you know, select writers, you know, I had a chance to work in L.A. for a little while, and, you know, was surrounded by the Bruckheimer machine for a little bit, and saw, you know, writers come in on, you know, a variety of projects. And it was just like amazing to sort of witness this. There's like this aura around, you know, you guys, and I'm not exactly sure how to put it into words, but it seems like a very exciting job. But at the same time, something that, like you said, you're devoting 80 or 90 hours to it, and you're hallucinating by the end of the week.
Sometimes. I mean, that usually means it's going well, if I'm seeing things or, like, hearing, you know, audio hallucinations or something. But it's like a work-induced schizophrenia that happens, because you get so engaged in something. But that's why I wanted to do it, and I like that part of it. You bring up Bruckheimer, and I've liked working for those guys. I mean, Jerry's been really good to me. I like Chad over there, and Melissa, and I'm still working with them now on other stuff. So it's been great for me to have, like, certain relationships that have never changed. Like, they don't go to my agents. They come to me. We all know each other, and we just trust each other. And those movies haven't gotten made yet. Now, couple of them are. One of them definitely is, that I can't talk about. But it's really exciting to see things happen after years. And then it's funny, I came back to a script for them recently, and I just did a few weeks of work on it, but I'd been away from it for a couple years, and I came back, and I really saw what was wrong. And so did Chad, who's Jerry's guy. We saw what was wrong in a way that we hadn't seen in years, and we fixed it, and suddenly the script did go over much better with everybody, and we are casting it right now, and it did change. So, I mean, a lot of times the screenwriter is at fault. A lot of times there is a little, some tiny little glitch that's not connecting with people. It's so hard to, with the limited amount of words you have and the limited amount of space to puncture somebody's emotions and psyche with a script, you just don't know how to carve that scalpel the right way, make that arrow pierce somebody correctly.
I mean, and I'd be completely insane for me not to bring it up. You know, Frank and I are big, we're big fans of Tony Scott.
I was just going to go there.
I'm probably the world's biggest Tony Scott fan. You know, Frank and I are working on a Tony Scott project together, and I have to ask about Top Gun 2 because, listen, it's like this, and I'm going to be honest. Top Gun is so fucking iconic. Like, yep. It is just... It's one of those movies that it was made in the pre-CGI days and Tony did it for real and they went out there
yeah.
and it was jets and it was the,
yeah.
you know, and I can't have Top Gun 2 be some sort of video game. And when Tony mm-hmm. passed away, I said to myself, okay, like creatively, where, you know, unless you get Michael Bay or Ridley Scott to do this and they're committed to getting all of the ingredients right, tell me about Top Gun 2. What was it like working with Tony, and will we ever see this movie?
Well,
just all that.
Just, yeah. I guess that's a good answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. So Justin Marks is a very good writer. He's on it right now. He's a great guy, and he's a great writer. I'm not the pitcher of record on it. You know, we're like baseball pitchers sometimes.
Yeah,
and
I know.
The ball on that one has been handed to Justin Marks, who's a very good guy, and he's been pretty, you know, open with me about what he's doing. It sounds great. I know a bunch of people want to make the movie. I'll be honest with you about when I left. I left the project immediately after the tragedy with Tony because I was pretty shaken up by it.
I can imagine. Yeah,
I was with Tony 2 days before it happened. In Fallon, Nevada.
Yeah, from the stories that were told online, you know, a couple of days before what happened, he was scouting locations and on aircraft carriers with writers and producers. So,
yeah, I was with him at Top Gun in Fallon, Nevada. I was with him for a few days. I genuinely love the guy. He was the most fun ever. There's never been a more fun guy that I mean, that night we were like eating and drinking at a casino. This is that Thursday night before the Friday where we went around Top Gun. And he flirts with every waitress. He jokes with everybody. He's like, you know, he wants to experience everything. Like the guy was just fantastic. And I remember he would call me. I'm not going to try to do his accent, but he would just call me all the time. And he would just yell at me, but in the funniest ways. Like at one point, you know, he had this expression. He'd always say, "Just go kill, Pete. Kill. Go kill it." And he, and then one time he was mad at me that I was taking a little too long, and he told me he was going to shower in my blood if I didn't hurry up. And I just started laughing, and then he started laughing. And it was the most brilliant thing because he did take everything that seriously. He did care that much, but like he was joking at the same time that he was serious. And like he got you to care as much as he did. He was like a climber, and he had these assistants that you know, Steve and Tom that used to like have to get him off the side of a mountain because Tony would go ice climbing, and then like a storm would come in, and he like on his cell phone call his assistants and be like, "Come rescue me on the side of a mountain," and they would, and that's like how adventurous he was with everything he did. He was the coolest guy, and I just And then I thought it was a joke when I was told on Sunday. Like I just thought it was a joke, and I kind of shut down, and I didn't want to work on the project anymore. I just emotionally couldn't work on the project. I don't know that we'd figured out what I was doing yet on the project. You know, like I'm not going to lie to you and say that I had cracked that script completely. You know, like I had it perfect, and I really didn't. I think there were a lot of things left to be decided in the draft. I think that's what that trip had been on Friday, and I hadn't turned in officially. And there were a lot of different ideas about the movie, and everybody was listening. Everybody understood, and Jerry understood. Jerry's a great guy. Jerry was really shaken up. Everybody was really shaken up. Tom was really shaken up. It hit us all in the face really hard. And I remember talking to David Ellison, who's co-financing the project, and he just wanted to put it away for a while, just to let everybody recover. And then we did have a conversation about it again, where I just told everybody, I don't think I'm able to go back, and I'm going to see Tony in every page. I'm going to see him in every note. There's no way I'm going to write this script as anything other than a eulogy if I go back and write it, and that's probably not the most creative or efficacious way for me to go about it. So Justin Marks came on, who didn't have that history with the project, and he was just a great guy about it. I talked to him a bunch of times. Most of the same people have stayed involved all the way through. It sounds like he's keeping some of what we talked about bringing Val Kilmer back and Tom Cruise and a lot of the same characters back in some capacity. And some of the core ideas that Tony and Tom Cruise had talked about, I think, are still in it sounds like. But I can't give you a prognosis on whether or not it's going to happen or not. I can't tell you right now.
I mean, listen, that's probably more than most people know about the project, and thank you very much for talking about it. I mean, it's one of those movies that's so important to so many people, and in this day and age when every single movie is getting a reboot, a remake, or a reimagining, there's certain films that, you know, I understand that Top Gun isn't Citizen Kane, but for a lot of people, that movie is the shit. And yeah. I mean, that movie 1,000 times when I was a kid, and I think that's one of three of Tony Scott's greatest achievements. And it really was one of those movies back in the day that, you know, it was just one of the ultimate calling card films for a director to ever make. And, you know, I'm just it's just one of those important films to me, as is the Bad Boys franchise. And again, it's amazing that you've worked on some of these huge things. I know Joe Carnahan, at least what we're told, and, you know, from what Frank and I know, Carnahan is working on it now. That's another project that you at one point took a pass on or a crack at the script.
Well, I was actually the first on that. I was on it for 2 years on that one.
Is this when it was Bad Around the World, or was that was this when it was renowned as Bad Around the World? I seem to remember there was like a Brian Helgeland screenplay back in the day that was like the Bad Boys 3, one of the first drafts or something. Was this like?
I do think that was out there. I do think that was conceived even before me. I'd heard about that, but I hadn't seen that. I was just working on it at Sony for a couple of years, and I think it was a good experience. I think that movie looks promising right now. I mean, I think it's come off of some of what I was doing. This sort of the villain plot of mine is totally gone from that, which I think is probably a good thing, because my villain stuff gets so dark that it throws off movies sometimes. I've heard really good things about where that is right now. So one thing just to back up with the Top Gun thing that I'll say, just to assuage your worries a little bit, is I really believe in Jerry and David Ellison and Tom and all these guys, and they're not going to make that movie unless it's great. I mean, I don't worry that there's something that's going to come out that is that's cartoonish, because David Ellison and Jerry are so passionate about that, and so is Paramount, and then Tom cares so much about it. They're not going to do anything to hurt that legacy. Those guys are really serious guys, and they're. Their taste is good their taste is really good about this movie. They're not gonna let it go awry. Yeah.
Yeah. If there's been few more consistent hands at popcorn blockbuster movie making, it's been Jerry Bruckheimer. I certainly would have all the faith in the world that he'd be able to deliver it. It's just one of those movies that when you hear the phrase sequel, you know, you're just like, wow, okay, what's this going to be like, and how's it going to play and, you know, 2016. And what I would love to ask about something like Bad Boys or a script where you said you were the first one on, whether or not you're the first writer on a big project or the third or fourth or fifth writer, what is it like to morph your ideas with somebody else's and try to keep everything the same tone? And
interesting. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that's, you have to do that on everything anyway, though, because this is such a collaborative process, period. So you're, you know, like, for instance, on the Hunger Games movies, I came in after Danny, and it winds up not it doesn't matter where you are in the process, because there's so many problems that have to be solved in that transition of going from words to film, you know, and there's so many things to be solved the day of. There's so many things to be solved between one draft and another. I mean, it's this kind of Zeno's paradox of like you're just crossing infinitely smaller increments of space. And it's creative, but you get into a kind of intense problem solving that takes over everything else. And the adapting your voice to something happens even if it's the most original idea in the world that you've done, which I haven't had that experience, but I've had some originals. You still adapt it to a director that comes on. You still adapt it to the producer that comes on. You still adapt it to what an actor is comfortable doing or what's their wheelhouse, what isn't their wheelhouse. You're still adapting it in the edit. You're still audience testing it. You're still trying to figure out what works. I mean, you really have no idea what's going to work until you see it. And so you're constantly adjusting the lens all the time. So it feels like it would be really different to come in and try to adjust to this voice that's already there, but it's really not, because you're really doing that to some degree always.
I don't know how much you can speak about this, but I'm very curious how daunting of a task it is to adapt The Odyssey to film.
It's hard. It's really hard. it's really hard in a movie of reasonable length.
Right.
And it's really hard. What's that?
I mean, like, that's a minimum of 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard also because so many things have riffed on The Odyssey, so you feel like you've seen a lot of those episodes within it, even if you haven't seen it portrayed exactly that way. I mean, I know we're going for sort of the Game of Thrones version of it. I mean, I can say that because I'm friends with both the guys that write that show, and I told them that, and they were like, oh, that's the only way to do it. making fun of me.
The only way you could get The Odyssey made now is if it was Game of Thrones style.
Sort of the Game of Thrones version, but it's not. I mean, we have to do justice to it at the same time. I mean, it's a classic, and you can't overly adapt it. You can't leave things out. You just have to tell it from an angle that feels different. And the only thing I'll reveal is that the second act is the hardest, as it is in a lot of scripts, because there's a lot of very episodic stuff that has to be sewn together in a way that feels like cause and effect. Contemporary movies are very specific about how one event informs another, and you know, Homer wasn't quite beholden to Sid Field the same way studios are. That's a joke. Take that. You can leave that in there, but I'm emphasizing that I'm saying that and exaggerating.
No, that was awesome. That was awesome.
And
it's a joke.
You know, it's another thing. You know, and
to Sid Field. Yeah.
You know, and to sort of bolster what Frank was saying, you know, your work has predominantly been, as far as I can tell, adaptations. Outside of obviously the novels that you've written, I meant for the screen. Is that something that has just happened that way? The original screenplays that you've written, like you said, haven't gotten made or are in the process of getting made. I mean, what's it like being known as maybe the guy to get to adapt something? Because that's what it seems to the outsider.
Yeah, because it's what it is. I mean, I've written original scripts, definitely. I mean, they're the ones that I talked about that got me those jobs. I mean, but they just by, you know, luck or circumstances, they haven't gotten made. I mean, one of them, which is a script I care about a lot, has fallen apart several times, like with a start date, like very cast and very close to shooting. Director, financing, everything, and fallen apart a few times for all kinds of reasons I can't go into. You know, lawsuits from, you know, various people that should have been producers on it. You know, financiers losing their money, and you know, threats from cartels, that kind of stuff. You know, there's
just that. Okay.
Yeah, the plug's been kicked a couple of times on some things that were originals, but it's fine because you don't, the process is a little different, but it's there's a lot more adaptations that get made anyway, because everybody wants something to stand on. That has to do a little bit with the development process and the process of selling something, that people are so much more confident about a project when it's existed in another form. I wish it wasn't like that, but it is like that. And so there's an awful lot of adaptations that are out there to be made, and that's why you probably see more of it in general. There's a few originals I still have out there that I hope get made, and I think that's probably the limited series world for me a little bit.
Do you see yourself writing another novel?
Yeah, I want to. I keep getting drawn away from it, and I have all these half-finished books, but it's really hard when you leave something for 2 years to go work on a movie to come back to it and figure out what the hell you were talking about. You can't, especially with early drafts. All early drafts are like a fever dream. Like, you don't really know what they mean until you go back to them and go through that really like difficult, tough love process of figuring it out. So I just haven't had the time yet to go back and do that. You need about a year to at least to do it. So at some point when my family is off, I have a daughter in college now, so maybe she's going to a state school, so maybe I can take the time off and do it. Yeah.
And what can you tell us about, I know we're going to be mindful of your time, what can you tell us about Hunter Killer? Because that's the submarine thing with Gary Oldman and Gerard Butler, and sounds very genre, and it's right up my alley.
It's a cool movie. It just started shooting on Monday in London. Jerry Butler is a great guy. I've talked to him a bunch about it. That's an interesting one. I mean, that goes back to your conversation talking about which writer are you. I mean, on that one, I've been the third, sixth, and ninth, I think. You know what I mean? So it's like baseball, where pitchers can come and go, except we're allowed to come back into a game for an inning here and there. And I like the producers a lot on that. I like the directors, so I've kept
directing
acquainted.
That?
Say it again. Donovan Marsh. He's a South African director, everybody feels really confident about him. He wrote and directed a movie called I Number Number. Do you know that movie? I don't know.
No.
It's worth a look. And he's seems to be going really well, so I'm excited about it. It's at that very nascent stage where you got to be very tender and delicate and helpful and loving to something and hope that it all comes together. But it's basically just a straight shot action movie. Like, it doesn't make any qualms about being anything other than that, and it doesn't have a great deal of exposition, which I kind of love about it. It just, here's your premise and just go. And, I'm usually satisfied with those kinds of movies because I know the contract. You know, don't waste my time. And,
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the economical thriller. Something like last year's very underappreciated Black Sea. I don't know if you saw that film.
Yeah.
That's the kind of movie I like. I like that movie. I didn't have to be submarine movies. But I want five or six of those movies a year,
right?
And I just feel like that's not happening on a, at that level. Like we sort of talked about before, you're either talking about these really big things or you're talking about an independent production. But then every once in a while you get this, and I think in the case of Black Sea, that might have been a UK production of some sorts, Kevin MacDonald, so probably in some way or shape or form. But in any event, that's the kind of movie I want to see, and I'm glad that you're involved in making that kind of stuff, because there's people out there that want to watch that kind of stuff. There's a big market for it still.
I do. I always wanted to watch it. So I'm catering to some part of my own reptile brain with those kinds of movies. Like I've always liked a movie that didn't waste my time too. Like, I want to go to a movie that's, thrilling and intellectual and has beautiful character development and all of it also. But I've also liked movies that just know what they are immediately and follow through on it. And look, that can be genius too. I mean, Fury Road was pretty genius, and it's just, that's a straight action movie. I don't, it's one of the most artfully done action movies ever made, if not the most. But it, I like how it's going to probably make all action movies more economical, because everybody realized, like, wait a minute, we don't need to explain all that stuff. We don't need to have those scenes where you do that. It's everybody loved that movie for skipping all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. In order to have to be 2 hours and 40 minutes, you can tell an amazing, thrilling story in 2 hours and not hammer the people over the head with, like you said, a ton of exposition and be visual with your storytelling. I mean, for, in my opinion, that's what movies are really for. It's a visual escape mechanism. You go, you sit in a big dark theater, you watch something, you get taken to another place you've never been, hopefully. You know, and in the case of Fury Road, Jesus, I mean, that movie is just, you know, Frank and I have discussed it at length. Yeah. It's outrageous. And George Miller at the age of 70 showed, you know, his younger, competition how to do it. So, this has been a really awesome chat. Again, definitely want to be mindful of your time. I know you're a busy guy and we don't want you hallucinating tonight after chatting with us.
Scary, but I'm going to get committed if you guys, I'm worried about some of that, but that's all right. It's all fine.
Man, thank you so very much. And we're very excited for Blood Father.
Yes.
So we both can't wait to see this film.
Very cool, guys. I hope you like it. And thank you. This was fun for me too. Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Nick. Very cool.